Okay, welcome back, members. It's great to see many of you. We have a full agenda today. So first I'm going to call the Human Services, Finance, and Policy Committee to order, and then we'll take roll call. So Lindsay?
Good morning. Can everyone hear me? Okay. Chair Schultz?
Present.
Vice Chair Bonner?
Present.
Reed Albright? Representative Walden?
Present.
Representative Burkle?
Present.
Representative Fisher?
Fisher, present.
Thank you. Representative Frederick?
Present.
Representative Hansen?
Hansen, present.
Thank you. Representative Keel?
Present.
Good to see you, Representative Keel. Representative Liebling?
Present.
Representative Mueller?
Present.
Representative Noir?
Present.
Representative Novotny?
Present.
Representative Pearson?
Present.
Representative Pinto?
Present.
Thank you. Representative Rasmussen?
Rasmussen, present.
Representative Robbins?
Present.
Good morning. Representative Sandel?
Present.
And Representative Schumacher is excused, and I see Lead Albright. Good morning, sir.
Good morning.
Thank you.
So we do have a quorum. Thank you, everyone, for joining us this morning. The first item of business is to approve the minutes from April 8th of last year, 2021. So hopefully,
Madam Chair.
I'm going to have, for Representative Albright, I think you were excused from that meeting, but you should check the minutes. So I'm going to see, I think we'll have Vice Chair Bonner move the minutes.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I would be happy to move the minutes from April 8th.
Thank you. So we'll take a voice vote. So please unmute yourself. All those in favor of approving the minutes from April 8th, 2021, say aye.
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 Aye. Any opposed? Any abstentions? Okay, the minutes are approved. Well, members, like I said, we have a full slate today. First, we're going to hear a presentation from the DHS Commissioner Harpstead about the workforce crisis in our caring professions. As I'm sure all of you know, that there's a shortage of workers in many industries in Minnesota, but it's particularly worrisome in our healthcare area because so many vulnerable people in Minnesota depend on PCAs, home care workers, behavioral health therapists, nurses, staff in group homes for their care. And the alternative for many, if they can't find a PCA, is to go into a nursing facility, which they wish not to avoid, or rely on family members if they're fortunate to have family members that can provide care. So we're going to hear from the commissioner about this crisis in our caring professions, and then we're going to hear testimony from providers about their experience. And after that, we're going to take up House File 2914. This is a bill to extend some of our COVID waivers so we can begin in the near term to at least alleviate some of the barriers that our providers are facing. So I hope we can have a good discussion and listen to the experience of providers and then all work together in a bipartisan way to come up with immediate solutions and then long-term solutions. So to get started, I'm going to introduce DHS Commissioner Harpstead to the meeting. Welcome, Commissioner Harpstead. And I'm assuming you have a slide deck that someone will share. And members and people of the public, all of the material you can find on our committee website on the Minnesota House of Representatives, including written testimony.
Well, thank you, Chair Schultz. Good morning, committee members. Yes, we have a slide deck. So as Chair Schultz mentioned, today I want to talk to you about our caring professions workforce. Here's some statistics from the Minnesota State Demographer's Office. As you can see, the labor force growth in Minnesota for the last four decades is slowing rapidly, and for the next many years is going to be much lower than it has been in the baby boom generation. We have all known this was coming for a very long time, but of course, COVID and the Great Resignation have totally exacerbated this issue and brought it to the forefront. And we have providers across the state struggling with it now. Next slide. The caring professions are all those frontline workers we applauded throughout the pandemic: nursing home, assisted living, group homes for people with disabilities, behavioral health services, home-based care services, childcare, and health care. They represent together 15% of the entire Minnesota workforce, a higher percent than some other states. DHS likes to say we support 1.7 million Minnesotans in some way every year, which would mean that 15% of the Minnesota workforce serves at least 30% of the Minnesota population. Next slide. The average wage in these caring professions is about 30% below the average Minnesota wage. While the average Minnesota wage has risen 4.3% over the past year as employers compete for workers, this data is from Indeed. While, of course, all of Minnesota will suffer from a workforce shortage over the next four decades, the prevailing wage in this sector makes it particularly vulnerable. It's also an equity issue. We've pulled just a couple of categories of caring profession workers, and you can see the percent who are BIPOC, the percent who are female, the percent who, in addition to being 30% below the average wage, or perhaps because they are 30% below the average wage, are also on our medical assistance program and are also receiving SNAP food benefits. Next slide. Sources of funding for these caring professions are 46% government for hospital workers and 32% government for nonprofit providers. So the point I wanted to make here is that responsibility for the vitality of the caring profession sector rests with state and federal government, or in other words, all taxpayers. This sector is a public responsibility. We won't be able to count on the private sector to solely solve the problem. It is also true that the white American post-World War II population was the first in the history of the planet to send its elders, people with disabilities, and family members with behavioral health issues to live with 24/7 staff because it could afford to. Even if we could afford it going forward, we can't staff 24/7 congregate care for so much of our population any more than other countries can. Developments like Amazon delivery, grocery and pharma delivery, Uber transportation make it more and more possible for people to remain in their own homes for as long as they need and want to, so that helps. Next slide. So we will need new models, and the independence package that passed in last session with the HHS bill to support home care was the sort of investment we need. Still, it would take some years for new models to be established and for providers to change some of their approaches to the services, and this sector will need a smooth ramp down, not a cliff. A recent McKinsey report reviewed by the Council on Economic Expansion said that as automation and home delivery reduce the need for retail sales, administrative, and production jobs, the fastest growing sector will be the caring professions with their required social skills that cannot be automated. This is DEED's job vacancy survey findings in the second quarter of 2021, and you can see the medium-colored blue wedge up on the upper right is the healthcare and social assistance sector with a large number of job vacancies. Next slide. Some things that we've done together over the last couple of years. Key provisions that were passed in the 2021 session, the PCA rate framework, which brought PCAs, will bring PCAs by June to $15 an hour, an historic increase in that PCA rate. And at this point, $15 an hour doesn't look as big as it did last year when we look at some of the other kinds of wage competition that we're facing. The CCAP rate increase last year was a major step forward in supporting these professions. The legislature also passed an early DWRS rate increase for group homes for people with disabilities and other waivered services, and that began to be available to those providers in January. It rolls out throughout the year, approximately 1/12 for the next 12 months. The HCBS Home and Community-Based Workforce Development Grants have been a benefit, and provider capacity grants for underserved communities. So a lot of investment in this area in last year's session. Appreciate that. Next slide. The governor's resources or federal resources over the last couple of years to nursing facilities, staffing for four hospital decompression sites by MDH, waiving nursing facilities repayment of federal grants and loans received during 2020, which was a federal requirement, nursing facility emergency grants for additional staffing from DHS, emergency 12A10 Medicaid funding for nursing facilities and emergencies by DHS, and a temporary interim Medicaid payment rate this January, which was budget neutral. It was an early increase in the rate that they were going to receive anyway. Next slide. Governors and federal resources to other providers. The temporary emergency staffing pool, a COVID-only response, was available until it ended in December of 21, which was came from CRF funds. An emergency staffing pool with hospital supplemental staffing from MDH. Emergency funding to address staffing shortage in group homes and services provided in a recipient's home, which we recently enacted through our 12A10 emergency authority. And so you can see a total of $250 million almost in resources from all these sources over the last several years. Next slide. And finally, key provisions in the governor's proposed budget impacting the caring professions include a proposal called the caring professions, which are basically focused on DHS licensed facilities, including services for people with disabilities, behavioral health facilities, and home care types of services. The healthcare workforce revitalization package in the MDH proposals. And then another CCAP rate increase and child care stabilization supports for the child care profession, which not only needs its own support, but is, of course, the workforce behind the workforce for all of these other sectors. And so just in closing, I want to say that this whole phenomenon needs serious attention by all of us in the public sector, and I appreciate your attention to this issue.
Thank you, Commissioner, for that presentation. We really appreciate all the work we were able to accomplish last year, and I know we have more to do. Members, we can take questions, a few questions. We'll save any comments you may have until we're through with the agenda. Okay, see Chair Liebling.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And Commissioner, just one clarifying question about something that you said. One of your slides, you said that where the funding comes from for the workforce. You said that 46% of the funding for hospitals is government. And I just wonder if you could explain that a little bit. That is, just to explain what that means, because that was surprising for me to hear. Thank you.
Commissioner?
Thank you, Chair Schultz and Chair Liebling. That, of course, comes from DEED and is the sum of the Medicare, Medicaid kinds of funding that supports our hospital sector, which then supports the hospital workforce. So that's why it is that high. And you can see how that comes with the matching dollars. And then the other almost just over half would be from private insurance.
Chair Liebling?
Yeah, thank you, Madam Chair. Okay, thanks. I guess I was thinking that meant that the staff was paid by government. And so thank you for clarifying that. Appreciate it.
Representative Knorr.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Commissioner, I just wanted to inquire about the pay. As we look into the data from DEED, home health and personal care aides paid around $30,000, which is one of the least paid profession. And we've been seeing the great resignation, people moving to jobs that pay more than the $15 that we approved. What is the projection when it comes to helping individuals have a family sustaining wage and to also be able to do the care for the elderly that who have been asking for help, you know, with the workforce shortage and the challenges that we're facing.
Commissioner?
Yes, Chair Schultz and Rep. Noor. I am not sure what it is this month. As you can imagine, those numbers are shifting rapidly. And I've heard all kinds of different numbers. We'd have to look some things up and get back to you on what's now considered a livable wage in Minnesota. And I would also just add that the competition for this workforce is really outweighing the question of a livable wage, because the kinds of things people are doing to attract a workforce to keep their services and businesses operating is more dramatic right now than thinking about what a livable wage would be. But it's a very important question, and I'd have to go and get some more data to answer your question.
Representative Noor?
No, thank you so much, Commissioner. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Okay, any other questions from members? I'm not seeing any. Thank you, Commissioner Harpstead. We will now move to testifiers, and we'll hold questions until we get through all the testifiers. So the first testifier is Osa Mohamed.
Yes,
if Osa. You're here, welcome to the committee. Just please state your name for the record and if you're affiliated with an organization, and then begin your testimony.
Thank you, Chair Schultz and committee members. My name is Osa Mohamed. I am a single parent of two children with disabilities. I am a frontline healthcare worker that's much very, very needed at this time. I had to cut down on substantially from my employer. I was from full-time to part-time to now casual. I've been looking for trustworthy PCA for the past year. My employer has been very understanding of my condition, but right now I'm extremely nervous of losing my job. I don't have that many family members here to help me, and my family has been personally been very affected by the shortage of staff. And the only way I could able to afford food and roof over our head is the SSI and CSG wages, the income that I've been receiving. I am asking our committee to increase or remove the cap of the 40 hours for parent pay and the living wages. This has really taken a heavy toll on me mentally, not being able to find a trustworthy PCA. And the fact that my story is definitely not unique is even more frustrating. So I'm kindly asking for more options, if there's more options for individuals like me and families like me alike. I would appreciate it. Thank you so much for taking the time to listen to my story.
Well, thank you, Ms. Mohamed, for sharing your story. And I really, really feel sorry for all of parents like yourselves that are struggling to find PCAs. So I hope we can provide some assistance this session for you. But thank you for taking time out of your day to be with us and to share your story and your experience.
Thank you so much for listening.
Okay, the next testifier is Sue Shuttle. Please state your name and affiliation for the record and then proceed with your testimony.
Thank you.
And welcome to the committee.
Thank you. For the record, my name is Sue Shuttle and I'm the CEO of ARM. ARM is a trade association representing 170 provider organizations who support people with disabilities where they live. My brief testimony today will focus on direct support professionals, who they are, and some talk about some industry trends that we're seeing, and then focus on a few of our ideas. So direct support professionals are not PCAs or home health care aides. Direct support professionals are the workforce behind providing in-home supports to people who are covered under the DWRS waivered programs. The people that they serve live in group homes, ICFs, and in their own homes. The trends that we're seeing around workforce in this sector are troubling. We're looking at, when we look at unfilled jobs, we are seeing a 30% vacancy rate, which is about 9,000 open positions, compared to 20% in previous years. So we're seeing definitely an uptick in open positions. 43% of the direct support professionals leave within 6 months, and then 67% leave after a year. 21% that they report that they leave due to low pay, and 16% report burnout and being overworked and childcare needs. So what do these trends mean? It means that the open positions are trending in the wrong direction. We can't retain and keep staff in the door. The existing staff then must do more. They must cover more shifts. And we're seeing a lot of burnout from the existing staff, which is obviously a very big concern. And we're also concerned about health and safety issues, just given the overworked nature of the workforce. So ARM conducted a survey of our members recently, and the data shows what's happening in the industry. 54% of our members who responded said that they're reducing capacity, resulting in about 260 beds, fewer beds. 47% of our ICF providers are reducing capacity, which is about 90 beds. 28% have temporarily closed programs. 25% have permanently closed programs. And what this is meaning is that providers are having to consolidate people, moving them from their existing homes, and in some cases, moving people home. And in other cases, in the worst situation, is moving people to emergency rooms. So what can we do? This is a big problem. Commissioner Harbstead touched on a lot of this, but ARM is asking the legislature to take immediate steps in the form of short-term actions to maintain the staff that we have. We have legislation proposing retention bonuses for the staff, existing staff, to remain in their positions until the end of 2022. Talking about a scholarship program as well, and grants to assist with the needs around childcare. We also need long-term solutions. Currently, the average wage of a direct support professional is just over $14 an hour. We need additional investments in the competitive workforce factor within the DWRS system to raise the wages routinely and create a sustainable and reliable network. I want to thank the chair for holding this hearing today, and for our ongoing commitment to the people with disabilities. We know this is very complicated, but we're eager to work together to find solutions. Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Shuttle, and thank you for that testimony and for providing our committee with possible solutions. The next testifier is Lauren Thompson. Are you with us today?
Yes, hello.
Welcome to the committee, Lauren. Please state your name for the record and then proceed with your testimony.
Lauren Thompson. Members of the committee, my name is Lauren Thompson, and I'm a disability rights advocate from District 45. I have cerebral palsy, and I rely on direct support care to survive every day. My mother was my primary caregiver, but she was injured. And when we couldn't find enough PCAs, I've had to use facility services most of the time. The workforce shortage is so widespread that it's hard to know which services would give me the most security. I've been in a nursing home, assisted living, and group homes, in addition to PCA services. Inconsistent staffing leads to inconsistent care. At times, I've had to go without a shower, without a clean home, waiting hours for care, unable to make plans or have a job. Now I'm safer in a group home, but I have no control or privacy. The group home manages and documents my care, my food, and my activities. There is nothing I can do without either staff knowledge or staff consent. It is so expensive that it uses GRH funding, and I'm only allowed to have about $100 a month. I haven't found much peace in giving up my personal freedoms. But for many of us, the workforce shortage has made it so that the only way we can get the care that we need is to sacrifice our desires and our rights. Please understand that this is not just about restoring jobs. This is about restoring our humanity. I appreciate being able to talk to you about this today, and I would be honored to be able to be part of ongoing conversations because my life depends on these things. Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Thompson. And it is a priority to provide solutions so you can live independently again. So thank you for sharing your experience. And that will be our goal. I know myself and Senator Abler and members of our committee to make sure that you have more privacy, more independence, and can live the life that you desire. So thank you for taking time to come to our committee.
Thank you.
The next testifier is Lynn Noren. Welcome to the committee, Ms. Noren.
Morning, Chair Schultz, members of the committee. Thank you for the opportunity to testify today. My name is Lynn Noren, and I'm the president of RISE, an organization that provides employment and day support services to people with disabilities. I'm also the government affairs chair for MORE, a statewide association of 100 organizations that provide employment and day supports throughout the state. As we are all aware, Minnesota is currently in the midst of an incredibly challenging time due to the extreme shortage of workers available to provide the hands-on support necessary for Minnesotans with disabilities to live full lives. Organizations that provide employment and day support services are, like so many of our other providers, struggling greatly at this time to attract and retain staff. Our service providers across the state have for months now had growing waiting lists of people wishing to access services for the first time or to return post-COVID. In a recent survey of our members, service providers reported over 3,500 people are on our waiting list to access services. Those services will not be available until we make progress in addressing the workforce crisis. At RISE alone, we have over 250 people who are waiting to return to services or to start services for the first time. We'll need over 70 new staff team members to make that happen. The most alarming impact of this current lack of access to employment and other daytime supports is the negative impact on well-being and mental health of individuals who are seeking these supports. As we know from our own lives, having purpose and meaning to our day with the ability to interact with others that we don't live with is an essential component of daily quality of life. Additionally, the inability to find staff to support people with disabilities in their employment and day services has placed greater stress on their family members and their residential service staff, who are then responsible for providing services during the day as well. In addition to the staffing strain on already stressed residential providers, family members, like we've heard today, have had to leave their jobs or take long-term leave to provide support to their family members during the day. The system of supports for Minnesotans with disabilities is interdependent. As we are seeing on a daily basis right now, the lack of access to employment and day supports is contributing greatly to the unsustainable pressure placed on their residences. More members appreciate the investments that were made in disability services in the last legislative session. Those funds have made a difference, and service access would be even more limited without it. However, we are asking legislators to join with us again in this 2022 legislative session. We must increase the state set reimbursement rates to allow for staff wages and benefits that don't fall below those of our local fast food and other entry-level work opportunities. And MORE will bring forward proposals this session that can help move our state in this direction. We look forward to continued work together to address this critical issue of how to attract and retain staff needed to support people with disabilities in Minnesota to have full and meaningful lives. Thank you, and please don't hesitate to reach out with any questions you might have.
Thank you, Ms. Noren, for your testimony today, and hopefully you'll be here if there's any questions. And we appreciate all you do for people in Minnesota. Thank you. The next testifier is Damon Levistad. Please state your name and affiliation for the record.
Hi, my name is Damon Levistad. Speaking today for the council, Minnesota Council on Disabilities. I also work with SEIU. I'd like to thank Chair Schultz, Vice Chair Banner and the rest of the committee members for allowing me to speak today. I'm 48 years old. I currently live in Plymouth with my parents. David, Indiana. I was born with a neurological disorder called spinal muscular atrophy, and I've been in a wheelchair since I was 10 years old. I've been using home care services since 1992, which has allowed me to work for Barry Raymeyer Systems as a mechanical engineer for the past 29 years. As home care workers become increasingly difficult to find, and as my parents age and have less ability to help me, an impossible task for either of them to do individually, I am increasingly concerned about what my future has in store for me. Today, I am fine, but what about tomorrow or next week or next year when my parents are no longer able to care for me? Will I find enough help to continue to live at home and to work, or will I need to move into a living facility? I'm not alone in this concern, as thousands of other disabled and elderly Minnesotans are in similar situations. As a result, I've become increasingly active in advocating for change in home care services. Before the pandemic, the shortage of home care workers had been slowly rising, but starting in early 2020, it began increasing at an alarming rate. This has had a tremendous impact on those of us who rely on home care services because it inhibits our ability to have the security and stability in our lives that most people take for granted. Due to our inability to hire and retain quality home care workers, we know and trust our health, safety, and dignity needs have not been met. Without our basic needs being met, it is impossible to know what the future looks like. Planning for employment, time with family and friends, or getting involved in our communities have been set aside because survival has become our primary task. The time, energy, and challenges of finding home care workers leaves people with disabilities feeling very vulnerable and burdensome, and at times with little hope for the future. I'm confident, however, that if we work together, think outside of the box, and try new ways of doing things, the future can be amazing for all of us. In order to make this in reality, we must be willing to talk openly and listen diligently to the people who use and rely on these services. Failure to do so will cost lives.
Thank you, Mr. Life's Dad, for being with us today. And I know that I'm committed to helping solve this problem so you don't have to live with so much uncertainty in your life. No one should have to live with that level of uncertainty and fear. So thank you for being with us. I hope you can stick around in case there are questions. The next testifier is Dina Belisle. If you're with us, please introduce yourself and state your affiliation for the record, and then begin your testimony.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, my name is Dina Belisle. I am president of the Minnesota First Provider Alliance, a statewide trade association for personal care assistant and waivered service providers. I run a PCA agency providing both traditional and choice services. But most importantly, I am the mother to my son, Anthony, who is 40 years old and disabled and receives 12 and a half hours of PCA services a day. We appreciate this opportunity to provide testimony regarding the PCA workforce shortage crises. PCAs provide vital services for the most diverse long-term services and support program in Minnesota. Historically, the PCA program has been one of the lowest reimbursed services, with a reimbursement rate that is much lower than similar type services, increasing only $3.36 per hour over the past 14 years. That's 24 cents per year. With low wages, long hours, few benefits, and the demanding nature of the work, it has always made staffing difficult. The COVID-19 pandemic has amplified the workforce crisis. Many people have left the caregiving workforce, moving to jobs with fewer hours and higher pay in industries such as retail and fast food. Many PCAs who want to stay in the industry prefer to work with private pay clients versus clients on medical assistance, as they can be paid a higher wage. This has placed the health and safety of 44,000 people with disabilities and older adults at risk or forcing them to move to a more costly congregated care setting. Traditional providers who provide more support to clients are struggling to keep up with the demand of finding new staff, mostly due to high worker turnover and, of course, low wages for their current traditional clients. Many traditional providers are not taking on new clients because they are unable to meet the requirements to provide enough support and backup staff to safely meet the client's needs. This prevents new clients from being able to stay in their home or move back home from transitional care or hospitals. We take calls from clients and case managers asking us to help. It's heartbreaking to say, I'm sorry, we have no staff, over and over. Choice clients are working full-time jobs trying to recruit more workers. Some are getting by with one or two PCAs when they really need 3 to 4 PCAs to meet their needs. These clients are living with constant stress and anxiety of either staff getting COVID, exposing them to COVID, or not being able to find a replacement worker on such short notice, or needing to fill a void when a worker takes a much needed vacation or leaves for another opportunity. While we do not know the current number of unfulfilled open positions, Madam Chair, you stated in our last in-person hearing I attended in March of 2020 that you thought that number was as high as 15,000. I can't imagine how high that number is now 2 years later. The 10% reimbursement rate that was passed into legislation this last year allowed us to increase wages for our workers, only to be offset by the increase of food, gas, childcare, and housing. The increase helped to retain some workers, but not recruit more workers. And at the current rate of just $19.60, it's not enough for this valuable service. How do we address this workforce crisis and make the PCA program sustainable for years to come? First and foremost, we need to better fund the PCA rate framework passed into law last session and include language that would build cost-based adjustments into the reimbursement rate over time. This continued investment is essential to support the efforts of providers and individuals receiving services to recruit and retain workers. Further, we need to invest in the PCA framework that it would allow agencies to pay overtime for PCA workers who are working more than 40 hours a week. Lastly, we need to reduce the barriers of onboarding new PCAs, including reducing the time it takes for an individual PCA to be affiliated with a PCA agency. Similarly, we need to improve the process as we navigate the transition away from emergency background studies in a way that recognizes the increased financial burden the 2021 HHS budget imposed on agencies through increased fees and background study fees. Most importantly, we must all acknowledge that being a PCA is a necessary and valued career. Therefore, we need to create regular increasing viable, livable wages and benefits for this type of work. Thank you for letting me speak today.
Thank you, Dina. And your last point, so true. We have to change in our society how we value these caring professions. The next testifier I have on my list is Jinley Palin. If you're here, please introduce yourself for the record and begin with your testimony.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members. My name is Jinley Palin. I am the Executive Director of the Minnesota Association of Community Mental Health Programs, or MACMAP. MACMAP represents 35 community-based mental and chemical health providers across the state. Collectively, we serve over 200,000 Minnesota families, children, and adults in Minnesota public programs. Our mission is to serve all who come to us seeking care, regardless of their insurance status, their ability to pay, or where they live. I'm testifying to convey both the crisis state our community mental health and chemical health services are in, as well as some proposed solutions. My testimony is part of joint work, data, and experiences from across our association, Aspire Minnesota, and the Mental Health Providers Association of Minnesota, some of the three largest mental health provider associations in the state. And I know that my colleague, Kirsten Anderson, will be following up after my testimony. Similar to the testifiers who have gone before me, our state community mental health and chemical health programs are struggling to keep open services during this ongoing pandemic and extreme workforce crisis. These crises compound pre-pandemic sustainability issues, such as reimbursement rates that are far below the costs of providing services, which is having a direct impact on our ability to keep up with salary needs and demands that we can offer to our staff, and growing reporting and regulatory administrative requirements that all of our agencies are trying to navigate through during this staffing crisis and shortage of supply. In these crises, agencies and programs are still maintaining staff salaries, benefits, facilities, compliance reporting standards, as well as service operations. Agencies are now being forced to close programs, services, and locations and access points. The full impact is resulting in a lot of provider agencies not being able to keep open programs or keep up with our clients and population's growing needs for care. We have some data that we had conducted over the last several months of 2021. One was we've calculated close to 9,500 people or 9,500 people on waiting lists at our agencies trying to get into services. And this is with our staff that are remaining working at more than 100% capacity. I may, if I could, also note that many of these agencies noted they had no waiting lists earlier before the pandemic and in the early months of the pandemic and have gone from that to almost 10,000 folks waiting for services. We have across our providers over 700 unfilled staff positions. On average, that's 21 unfilled positions per agency. One large agency reported 160 unfilled staff positions currently. And on average, our programs are suffering projected losses of nearly $500,000 or $500,000 that they're budgeting to lose in calendar or budget year 2022. Similar to the information that Commissioner Harpstead shared, we are seeing an increase or have seen an increase of 32% across the cost to provide services on, as other folks have said, flat reimbursement rates in our Medicaid system. We have many mental health centers and programs in Greater Minnesota who are near closure. For these providers, there is no backup in their counties if these agencies close, and hospitals and emergency departments will then be the only source of care and will have to absorb the demand. One program conveyed their hospital emergency departments are very concerned about this risk of the increased hospital and ED usage if that happens. Our urban community mental health and chemical health programs also making up a significant portion of our safety net for medical assistance and underinsurance population in the metro are also closing programs and sites. Because our programs are safety net providers and we do not turn anyone away based on their ability to pay, they are absorbing all of these costs, which is compounding their uncompensated care losses. In 2014, the state of Minnesota lost the Riverwood Mental Health Center, which was a mental health center serving Chisago, Ashanti, Kanabec, Mille Lacs, and Pine counties. And this prompted an analysis that the state of Minnesota conducted on the impact. I believe it was shared in the committee packet. We're very concerned that Minnesota may see similar impact again if we permanently lose mental health programs or lose entire mental health centers in the coming 1 to 2 years. Our solutions that we're asking the committee and the legislature to help us support, first is an immediate relief funding request to sustain access to current community mental and chemical health services. We're also seeking and working with many different members and the department to streamline and reduce reporting and regulatory burdens, especially during this time, which will allow providers to focus on care delivery over reporting requirements. And third, we are really looking and supporting rate reform to our medical assistance outpatient chemical health and mental health program reimbursement costs. We support this study that the Department of Human Services passed in 2021 and that they are working on and that you all passed. Thank you. We strongly encourage the state to begin with our mental health services in that first part of analysis to move that forward first. We're urgently asking the committee to increase resources and investments into our community-based mental and chemical health infrastructure. Our concern is if we let this infrastructure and our community system crumble, there will be nowhere for clients to go once they need to be discharged or to prevent them from having to need inpatient hospital care. Thank you so much, and please let me know if you have any questions.
Thank you, Ms. Palin, and thank you for sharing that. We really do have a dire situation in this state, and it's true in other states as well, where we're seeing huge increase in demand for mental health therapy across all age categories, and a shortage of behavioral health specialists and therapists. So thanks for spending time out of your day. I know how busy you are to come here and share that with us. And I know that how urgent this is to fix. So I hope we can do that this session and earlier in session, hopefully. Our next testifier is Kirsten Anderson from Aspire. Ms. Anderson, please state your name for the record and then proceed with your testimony.
Good afternoon, Madam Chair, members of the committee. Good morning. I guess it's already been a long day. My name is Kirsten Anderson. I'm the Executive Director of Aspire Minnesota, an association of children and family service providers serving statewide. We are grateful to speak with you today. The workforce crisis in children and family services is at a new height, and the crisis is the most grave for children's mental health. Today, we implore you to pass emergency funding to prevent further loss of workforce. Emergency funding could preserve current infrastructure and prevent more loss for children's mental health services. Our talented workforce has swiftly evaporated over the past 6 months. Examples include closures of over half of the day treatment capacity in organizations, school-linked mental health providers with 20 students waiting per school, a staff of 300 with over 50 open positions, and a residential mental health treatment capacity to decrease by 50%. The equation driving today's crisis is increased volume of need, more complex and acute mental health need, decreased staff to serve, and increased cost for recruitment and retention with decreased revenue. Current staff are overburdened. Trained executive teams are covering shifts, and as staff seek to do more, they are also struggling. One Greater Minnesota provider reported to us last week that three therapists independently approached the executive director to share their own struggles with suicidal ideation due to the layers of the crisis, including the inability to meet the needs shared by children and families. To be clear, the pandemic has exacerbated a crisis already in the making. With inadequate rate structures, low wages for highly consequential roles, and a decade of consistent closures in our children's residential mental health care. Positively, we see mutual support in the field at a height, sharing strategies to recruit and retain staff, creative benefits, flexibilities, and still our most critical roles are being outcompeted by retail, gas stations, and other entry-level roles. Pointing again to the perennial problem in mental health, the responsibility and impact of the work is not calibrated to compensation. To better understand the crisis throughout the mental health field, three mental health associations, Aspire Minnesota, MACMAP, as represented by Jenny Palin, and MHPAM, conducted a survey on workforce impacts. This is distributed to the committee. The data demonstrated that the workforce crisis is having a crippling impact across the entire continuum and yielding program closures, increased wait times, and precarious budget circumstances with monthly loss reports and increasing expenses on the horizon. The crux of the workforce crisis is without caring and skilled staff, there is no mental health care. To the solutions, with our children's mental health perspective in mind, we absolutely need emergency investment to prevent further harm to our children's mental health continuum, maintain current services, and begin to rebuild what we had in the past. The level of urgency here cannot be underscored enough. We need administrative simplification to focus staff time on delivering mental health care and not duplicative reporting that drives our professionals away from our Medicaid-serving field. We need a pipeline for licensure, and the NAMI workforce bill supporting future mental health professionals is of critical importance to building a viable future workforce. Looking to the future, critical work underway includes the DHS community-based Medicaid rate study to deliver a path forward for a rate structure that creates a sustainable future for our mental health servicers. And two shared responsibilities that we have and must embrace in the future are wage recalibration to set a base wage for mental health and youth workers that is commensurate to the level of training, responsibility, and value to our children and families. And parity is critical for a viable workforce in the future. Our commercial payers must participate in inadequately reimbursing for quality care. Too many children are going unserved, and our system requires all payers to be part of the solution. And first, today, emergency investment is necessary to preserve our current mental health infrastructure. Thank you so very much.
Thank you, Ms. Anderson. You know, often human services is typically an overwhelming committee with so many demands, but this year is even more so. And so I'm going to really be relying and will rely on Chair Fisher's division to really come up with more solutions and work with you in the behavioral health space. But thank you for being with us today. I know your job is overwhelming right now as well, but we appreciate you being here so you can share your experience and knowledge with us. The next testifier is Maren Holden from the Disability Law Center and Legal Aid.
Thank you so much,
Welcome Chair. To the committee. Just introduce yourself again and then proceed.
Sounds good. Good morning, Chair Schultz and members of the committee. My name is Maren Halden, and I'm an attorney at Legal Aid, which includes the Minnesota Disability Law Center. We are the Minnesota's federally designated protection and advocacy organization, and we provide free legal services to children and adults with disabilities in Minnesota. Thank you so much, as everyone has said, for your attention to this pressing issue. Our clients are impacted by all of the things that you've heard today. I will just add a couple things. First, we really see significant impacts of this on our clients with the highest needs. We have many clients with escalating mental health issues because of low staff or because of temporary staff who don't know our clients well. And these clients often end up in the ER or are evicted. And when that happens, as you've heard, it's usually the families who have to come up with the solution. And families are not a tenable solution without more support. As you heard from Ms. Mohammed, this can mean the parents stop working, or in other families, the parents are aging and may need supports themselves. So we think it's really important to find ways to support families who are supporting people who are losing supports. Second, you've heard from folks with lots of perspectives on different services, PCA, waiver services, mental health, but I just want to quickly note that this impact in home care nursing too. We've heard of one young man, for example, who's eligible for 12 hours of one-on-one PCA per day and 17 hours of one-on-one RN care per day. But during the month of December, his mom, who's a single parent, had to provide 134 hours per week of nursing care, care for him because six nursing agencies had no available RNs and there were no direct support to hire. Finally, I just want to emphasize how this puts a strain on our state's progress towards our Olmstead goals to ensure that people have the choice to receive the supports they need to live in the communities that they choose. As Ms. Thompson so compellingly shared, without people to provide supports, people lose the opportunity to live in the homes that they've chosen, and we often end up relying on more congregate and institutional settings, which can also be more expensive. We are really worried that this crisis is going to undo the progress that we've made toward our Olmstead goals, and that it will limit people's access to choice and autonomy for years or decades to come. We really see the need for a broad range of solutions and a solution for every setting, including when people live in their own home. We are part of the Minnesota Consortium for Citizens with Disabilities, and we, along with the Council on Disability and the Ombudsman for Mental Health and Developmental Disabilities, sent a letter with a wide range of recommendations. It's in the materials, and we just really look forward to partnering with you, along with all the other stakeholders and the testifiers here today, to come together around a full range of solutions this session. Thank you so much.
Thank you, Ms. Halden. We really appreciate your advocacy and voice here today. The next testifier I have is Nicole Mattson from Care Providers of Minnesota. Welcome, Ms. Mattson, to the committee. Please introduce yourself for the record and proceed with your testimony.
Thank you, Madam Chair. If I might, as part of the long-term care imperative, Jeff Bostic, if he could go first. We planned our testimony to kind of dovetail into one another, so we won't repeat things.
That's fine. Thank you, Ms. Mattson. So Jeff Bostic, Leading Age, welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members of the committee. My name is Jeff Bostic. I'm with Leading Age Minnesota. As Nicole said, part of the Long-Term Care Imperative, which is a collaboration between the two long-term care associations that represent virtually all of the nursing homes and a majority of the assisted living providers in throughout the state of Minnesota. I want to highlight a little bit of workforce data that we've collected recently, just completed actually in the last few days. We've been doing workforce data collection regularly from our members, and we've seen, you know, how alarming the situation has gotten in the second half of 2021 and how it continues to be a huge concern right now. For example, three quarters of nursing homes right now are not able to take admissions to their full capacity, which is creating access problems throughout the state as people can't get the services they need. There are plenty of beds available, but there are not people to staff those beds. And as a result, they're turning down admissions that they would ordinarily be able to take. The occupancy percentage in nursing facilities in terms of beds occupied statewide right now is 76%. That's an unprecedentedly low number. Typically pre-pandemic, it was between 85 and 90%. So we've seen a drop of 10%. And there would be recovery going on there in terms of higher occupancy if there was an ability to to have the staff to serve those people. Vacancies, that's something that everyone in this world is dealing with. We've seen a huge spike in vacancies in late 2021, and our latest numbers confirm that we're at around between assisted living and nursing homes. We have about 23,000 open positions that need to be filled. So obviously that's a very significant number. It would take a lot of recruiting to fill that gap. We've also seen that number spike from, it used to be about half that level. So it's been an ongoing challenge, but it's gotten to a crisis level in the last few months. And we've seen a big spike in resignations over the last few months, as a lot of areas have. Between August and the end of the year, assisted living and nursing homes had a net loss of about 4,500 employees. Meaning when you look at the people who left and the people that they were able to recruit into new jobs, they fell well short of being able to replace people. That's obviously an unsustainable situation if you keep losing there, keep losing employees. The key nursing and caregiver positions all have vacancy rates now between 20 and 30% in the nursing facilities and assisted living. What that does is, force a lot of use of overtime and temporary staff, which is not, again, not a sustainable model for being able to serve people. And we're already not able to take as many people into care as we should be able to based on the capacity that's available. Turnover is another driving factor there. We have about 60% annual turnover in the key caregiving positions like nursing assistants and home health aides. That's a much higher figure than we had seen in previous years. I also want to acknowledge the emergency measures that the commissioner highlighted, particularly around nursing homes. Those have been helpful. They made a little bit of an impact, but obviously we're still at a crisis type situation with the workforce, and obviously we're serving older people, vulnerable people, and the older population is going to keep growing into the future. So we need to get this problem fixed, get on the right path, and be prepared to deal with the age wave that everyone's been talking about for years. So I would like to, at this point, turn it over to Nicole. She's going to talk a little bit about our proposals for permanently addressing the workforce situation in long-term care.
Okay, thank you, Mr. Bostic. Hopefully you can stick around for questions. Ms. Mattson?
Thank you. Good morning, Madam Chair and members of the committee. My name is Nicole Mattson with Care Providers of Minnesota and here today with the Long-Term Care Imperative. Really appreciate the opportunity to speak with you today regarding workforce challenges that the long-term care sector is facing. And thanks to my colleague Jeff for highlighting all of our recent data points. As this presentation indicated, our members are facing unprecedented challenges, persistent negative trends of increased operating costs, increased staff turnover, high numbers of open positions, and a lack of qualified applicants, coupled with low census, have created a recipe for disaster that affect the overall viability of the industry. Providers are tenuously holding on to ensure that they can provide care to the current residents, but are unable to take new admissions from hospitals or the community because they simply lack the staff to do so safely. They're relying on an ever-dwindling pool of dedicated workers who, like many others have said, are exhausted and have been facing the pandemic nonstop head-on without abatement for nearly 23 months. As turnover persists and more workers leave, providers find that they're unable to attract new talent, and the number of open positions continues to grow, as Jeff's data indicated. This scarcity of qualified caregivers presents immense operational challenges, but also jeopardizes the ability for Minnesota seniors and disabled individuals to access care when and where they need it. We are very appreciative of crisis interventions such as the Minnesota National Guard, access to a lab tech staffing database, money for retention bonuses, and the 1,000 nursing assistant training initiative, which the administration has put in place to assist with interim stabilization. But also recognize that these are temporary solutions for a systemic problem. The most critical step in addressing our inability to meet the needs of seniors today and into the future is to raise the wages for professional caregivers. Chronic low wages in our sector make it difficult to attract and retain skilled, compassionate caregivers. Many have left the profession for jobs with less risk, less stress, and higher pay. Workers in long-term care need to be paid life-sustaining wages that are commensurate with the level of risk of the job, the skill level, professionalism, continuous training required, and the value that they bring to the healthcare continuum and overall public health. Low wages negatively impact job quality and perpetuate the notion that jobs in long-term care are not careers and require additional social supports to survive. We need permanent investments in Medicaid rates that will allow us to raise wages to compete in the current labor environment. Funding that will allow providers to be competitive enough to attract and retain highly skilled workers to long-term care as a career of choice, and to truly stabilize the workforce in order to meet the needs of our growing senior population. Seniors are being turned away from care services they need because of this unprecedented shortage in caregivers, and Minnesotans are at risk of losing access to needed senior care within their home communities if we don't permanently increase wages for professional caregivers. One-time solutions won't address the fundamental issue. It will take higher wages to recruit and retain the talent needed to fill 23,000 open positions. We appreciate your attention to these issues and definitely look forward to working with the committee as the session progresses on the details of our proposed solutions.
Thank you, Ms. Mattson. Our last testifier today is Sue Abderholden from NAMI. Welcome, Ms. Abderholden. Please state your name and proceed with your testimony.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members. Sue Abderholden, Executive Director of NAMI Minnesota. While a great deal of focus has appropriately been placed on the health impact of COVID and the ability of our hospitals to meet the needs, there is, frankly, another pandemic upon us, that of poor mental health. The impact of COVID on Minnesota's mental health has been great, especially on our children who have experienced greater depression and anxiety, our young adults who have experienced increased psychosis and suicidal ideation, and our adults, especially women, struggling with depression and anxiety as they tried to juggle distance learning and their employment, feared catching COVID, and much more. I want to also say that while we are in the same ocean, we are not in the same boat. COVID disproportionately impacted our culturally diverse communities, and children from those communities had more loved ones die from COVID. Prior to the pandemic, our mental health system was fragile and frankly not able to meet the needs of either children or adults. Workforce has been an issue for decades, with the shortage of child psychiatrists first mentioned in President Eisenhower's seminal report to the 2015 Minnesota report recognizing the shortages and the lack of a culturally diverse workforce. With the increased demand and the mental health workforce crisis reaching a peak, we are seeing firsthand the outcomes. Children struggling in schools are on waiting lists for school-linked mental health services. Their symptoms interfere with their ability to do well in school. When children cannot access care when they need it, we see them become suicidal, act out, and hurt their parents or siblings. When they do need a high level of care, they still have trouble accessing it. They can languish in the ER for days, even weeks. We call it boarding in the ER, which is really an odd term since they are not embarking on any journey. They are waiting and often not being treated while they are waiting. The calls we receive are heartbreaking. I spoke with a mom whose son was becoming very aggressive. She took him to the ER, but the hospital wouldn't admit him. She felt that she couldn't take him home because she has younger children and had no in-home services. She had been denied a caddy waiver the month before. Child protection was called. A 35-year-old man is really struggling with depression. He has private insurance. He calls the providers that are listed in his network, and none have openings. He feels hopeless. A dad called. His college-aged son is experiencing psychosis, hasn't really slept in over a week. The hospital beds are full. The first episode programs have waiting lists. He asked me, what can he do? A mom called whose son was becoming increasingly psychotic. She wanted to talk to a mental health professional who was also Black, but couldn't find one in her insurance network. An elderly woman called who is taking care of her husband who has a disability, and her daughter just moved back with them. Her daughter is becoming increasingly manic, is yelling at them, and mom is afraid she will hurt them. But there is nowhere for her daughter to go, and if she kicks her out of the home, the daughter will be homeless. We even have mental health practitioners and professionals calling us to help find resources for their clients. The lack of mental health professionals and especially culturally specific professionals is at a crisis point. Even at DHS, the SMRT team is overwhelmed with applications for TEFRA and Medicaid and don't have the staff to process the applications quickly. So when private insurance doesn't cover psychiatric residential treatment facilities or day treatment, families apply for TEFRA to have insurance to cover the treatment their child needs, and they have to wait months for the application to be approved. I could tell you additional stories, but I want you to know that there are solutions. Expand our mental health workforce by paying for supervision. Create incentives for mental health practitioners and others to become mental health professionals. Expand the health professional loan forgiveness program. Increase funding for peer and family specials to become certified. Increase funds for the Cultural and Ethnic Minority Infrastructure Grant Program. Establish and maintain a website to serve as an information clearinghouse for mental health professionals and people wanting to be one. And of course, increase rates and pay retention bonuses. Thank you so much for the opportunity to testify today. And I will say that Representative Vang will be introducing a bill building on the workforce bill that you passed last year to continue this work. Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Abderholden, for sharing those stories. And I know you also submitted a letter with a lot of the solutions that you just mentioned as well, so we appreciate that. Okay, members, does anyone have any pressing questions? This is not the last time we will be discussing workforce issues. We'll bring many bills to committee that we can have a more in-depth discussion. So we have 5 minutes for questions, and then we'll move on to the bill. And if we have more time, we'll take more questions. Representative Fisher.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And I'd like to thank the testifiers for coming out. I definitely agree that increasing rates is going to be very important to help address the problem. And the other part of the problem that I'm hearing is that it appears that we may not have enough total people to be able to do all the jobs that are needed out there. And so the question I have that as we increase rates, some of the providers are doing to try to attract people in from other states or from outside, attract people in from outside Minnesota? And what can the department itself do as we raise rates to help attract people in from outside the state? Because that's another way is we have to take a look, what can we do to increase the size of the workforce?
I think Mr. Livestad has his hand up. Does he have a response to Representative Fisher?
Yes, I do.
Go ahead.
So I use a lot of college students as caregivers, and as well as many of my friends who are disabled. And one thing that we believe would help is to have a college tuition program that would give college students a credit for their tuition if they work as home care workers during their college. And then another program would be similar to that, would be after they graduate from college, they've got a large amount of debt. So if they could have a program that would help pay back some of their college loans if they continued to work in home care after graduation. So a lot of caregivers graduate and they find a full-time job and then you're short workers. So if they could continue to work even one or two shifts a pay period, that helps tremendously. But if there's some type of incentive for them to do that, it would be a great help.
Thank you, Mr. Livestad. Ms. Shuttle.
Yes, thank you, Chair Schultz. One of the things that we see as a potential solution is the reliance of technology, to be able to utilize technology to support people who wouldn't necessarily need someone to physically be in their group home, for example, but technology can be used to monitor the individuals that are there. So I think that's more bang for your buck in terms of resources that you put into supporting people is looking at alternative ways of doing that.
Thank you. And we're going to go to Representative Moeller.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And actually, this is a good
follow-up to Representative Fisher's question as well, too. I just wanted to mention that Representative Robbins and I serve on the background studies, Human Services Background Studies Task Force. And one of the things we're looking at are people that are excluded from the workforce, but maybe shouldn't be. And there will be a report coming in the future to the legislature on that issue. I know Ms. Mattson, who testified, is I'm on a subcommittee with her, and she's been really helpful on that, as has DHS. So just wanted to alert everybody that that's coming, and that's also a potential solution.
Thank you for serving on that. We appreciate that. And, you know, the CNA, removing barriers to training, has been really successful. So I hope we can make it easier for people to get trained in these professions at no cost to themselves. Okay, we're going to move on, and then if we have time, we'll take more questions. The first bill we have for consideration this session is House File 2914. So I'm going to make a motion to re-refer House File 2914 to the Health, Finance, and Policy Committee as recommended. And I do have an amendment. So I'd like to move the A1 amendment, and then I will describe the amendment. If I could just get the bill in shape, and then we can discuss the bill. So this will be a voice vote. All those in favor of adopting the A1 amendment, please say aye.
Aye.
Any opposed? Okay, motion passes. The A1 amendment is adopted. I'm going to have, well, this simply is a bill, members, to extend some waivers to reduce some of the barriers. Hopefully you've had time to review it. It was posted on January 31st, but it allows oral and written signatures for applicants for public assistance programs. It allows video conferencing and monthly foster care visits by a child's caseworker when there is a declaration of an emergency. It waives mandatory direct contact supervision requirements while waiting for background studies to be finished. It allows qualified professionals to provide required in-person oversight of PCA workers via two-way interactive telecommunications for participants who receive PCA services. It allows program participants to give oral, written, or expressed approval documents related to long-term care services and supports that typically require in-person signatures. It also provides modifications to child care, and those provisions we're not going to discuss today. Those will be discussed in Representative Pinto's committee, and because he does have a clone bill. But it allows for the implementation of the temporary staffing pool. So if members have questions, we do have DHS here. Mr. Burdick is here. So if we'll take questions right now, and hopefully DHS can respond to those. Representative Robbins.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I want to support this bill. As we heard from the testimony, there's so much crisis out there in the workforce, and I've seen this in my own family, and it's dire for people who need this care. But I just have some concerns about particularly in Section 1, so I wondered if you or someone from DHS could address it. I'm very concerned of continuing to allow video care for foster care visits. I have spoken to people who do this work, and there have not been visits in 2 years, in-person visits. And I think it's very important that people go to the home. What you see on a video screen is very narrow. And so I have grave concerns about this provision. And I also, I'm not clear why it's necessary at this point in the pandemic. We really understand how COVID works. And I also wondered specifically, saying the federal or state emergency, the state emergency no longer exists. So, you know, I wondered why that language was chosen. So that's my first question. Thank you.
Thank you, Representative Robbins. And I believe counties came forward and asked for this provision, but I'm going to have DHS respond. Ms. Sommerfeld?
Yes, I was just coming on to say that my colleague Jimmy Sorensen will be joining us.
Okay, it's your colleague.
Good morning, Madam Chair.
There you are. Mr. Sorensen, welcome to the committee.
Thank you.
with regards to this particular provision, it did end in October of 2021. And so if there are concerns about children in foster care who've not received face-to-face visits since that time, it would be helpful for us to have that information so that we could certainly loop back and take a look. With regards to this particular provision, Federal Administration on Children and Families did allow the use of interactive video conferencing for the monthly face-to-face visit requirement because there have been situations where foster care providers were unwilling to physically allow someone to come to their home, or there was a really substantial desire to slow the transmission of COVID. And so it was a viable and meaningful opportunity. While there are both constraints regarding interactive video conferencing, there are also some positive elements of it as well. We don't perceive it to be the best practice or desired practice that we would want to implement long-term as a standard. However, in the ebb and flow of the pandemic, which seems to vacillate fairly quickly, there has been an impact on the workforce, there has been an impact on foster care providers, and there has been an impact on children. And so it is really a provision that allows the continuation of workers and agencies to serve children and families. And I'm happy to talk more about, you know, protocol, some of those positives, some of those challenges, if that's information that would be helpful.
Thank you, Mr. Sorensen. Is there someone from the counties that made this request here today that could respond to Representative Robbins' question? Yes, Mr. Youngerberg. Ms. Youngerberg, please proceed.
Sure. Would you like me just to offer my testimony at this point or just specifically answer the question?
You can offer your testimony, but put maybe first answer the question.
Sure. The question itself is a very important one, and one that speaks to the need to have quality of service. And so as counties view the insertion of CB 11 into this bill, the intent is not to diminish the quality of service and is not to diminish the fact that face-to-face services should, you know, we believe face-to-face services should be the standard. This would be an alternative when certain situations present themselves. And in my testimony, I have some examples that I think would directly answer the question in a way that might be sufficient.
Madam Chair.
Please, Ms. Representative Robbins.
Thank you to the people who answered, and thank you, Madam Chair. I would feel more comfortable, honestly, if there was, in a future version of this bill, some language saying that this is not the preferred mode. And I also would like to understand how this interacts with the county themselves declaring an emergency. Hennepin County still has their own emergency, even though the state does not. And I don't know when that's going to expire, but Hennepin County has told me on the record and sent me their plan that they don't necessarily plan to ever go back to full-time face-to-face. They plan to do hybrid. And so I would like to understand that what the go-forward plan is on this, and that this doesn't become default, or that people get to decide for themselves if they're going to do these in person or by video out of convenience, because this is a grave concern to me. Thank you.
This is, remember, only for emergencies as the language is stated, but Ms. Youngerberg, would you like to respond to that question?
Specific to the Hennepin County piece, I would need to, you know, connect with my peers in Hennepin County. This amendment does not speak to any local emergency declaration. It's that state and federal level. And so as a collective, 87 counties are asking for this. And so at that local level, this would not necessarily allow for that to occur.
Thank you, Ms. Youngerberg. Do you want to proceed with your testimony now, please?
Sure.
Thank you.
Good morning. My name is Angela Youngerberg, and I'm the Human Services Director of Business Operations for Blue Earth County Human Services. I am here today representing MACSA, which is the Minnesota Association of County Social Service Administrators, and MICA, the Minnesota Inter-County Association. The state's vulnerable populations have been significantly impacted by the pandemic, as you all know, and counties continue to work tremendously hard to respond to the demands of the shifting pandemic climate and to ensure that service delays and interruptions were minimized during this time. Peacetime emergency waivers and modifications issued by DHS and in effect until July of 2021 and separate dates for other waivers permitted county staff to change the delivery method of services without sacrificing service quality by doing such things as conducting client meetings via video and processing enrollment paperwork remotely when the only other alternative was not to conduct at all, when face-to-face was not permitted. We have found that the additional flexibility has resulted in the capability to provide greater flexibility in serving residents and more choices for how they interact with the county and community partners who share this work with us. In many instances, we've reverted back to, the of service delivery. The reason I'm here before you today is to recognize and thank you for recommending a series of the waivers to be reinstated, including an amendment to include CV 11 in this package. And so CV 11 waiver allowed caseworkers to conduct the federally required monthly visits with children in foster care to occur virtually by phone or video conference when the child's placement is not a concern, yet the health and wellness of the child, the facility or home or the caseworker is a concern due to illness exposure. So that's really how we see this working. Anecdotally, reports shared by frontline staff highlighted that this flexibility allowed them to spend more time with children, increase the quality of their visits, and decrease the amount of travel time for the worker, allowing them to spend more time with families while meeting the administrative requirements. So directly in speaking with staff and with supervisors, directly in our county, I can say that staff, especially most recently with this most recent surge, have been getting or staying nervous about the mandate of face-to-face, that child protection must always see kids in foster care face-to-face since CV 11 went away. And this isn't all visits. So these are a few of the visits that I'm talking about. And so we have staff that have to drive significant distances to see a child. And because of the nature of what's going on either in that facility or in that home, we see the child through the door or through a door or in a driveway in the winter because the family has COVID or has had a COVID exposure. And then what happens is then they turn around, they come back to the office, and then they initiate a video conference call to finish and conduct, a lengthy conversation at that point. So they've met the standard according to the letter of the law, but then they go back and do the video conferencing to get the spirit of the intention of the quality of service. And so other practice changes that we have made is, we really try to front load all of our monthly visits to the front of the month so that if there's COVID exposures, either for the worker, the child, the facility, the family, whomever it might be, that we have multiple times during the month that we can try to get back out into that household. And in a handful of circumstances, it's been near impossible to make that happen. For the most part, we've been able to make that happen. I have a couple of examples, but, they're real world examples, but essentially it's just that we get down to January 31st being the one and only day. And then there's a COVID exposure in the family and we can't go. The other side of it is when a facility that a child might be in they're no longer permitting any visitors because they change their rules to try and curb the spread of COVID or illness. And so we cannot physically enter the facility. And so that makes it a challenge. So counties support the standard of practice remain a face-to-face visit in usual circumstances. However, when the health and well-being of those involved in the visit are at risk due to illness, virtual visits be considered an acceptable alternative. So MACSA supports the amendment to include CB 11 in the package of waivers that would be reinstated. I'm happy to answer any other questions that you may have.
Thank you, Ms. Youngerberg. And members, I promise that we can work on this language if you have concerns, Representative Robbins. The next stop is health, finance, and policy. So let's work together. Let's just get this out of committee so we can get it to the floor so we can address the urgency of these waivers. And I know, Representative Pinto, you wanted to respond, so go ahead.
I give, Madam Chair, I see there's some other hands up and all, so I'll step out and allow you to move on to others, but thank you.
Okay, Representative Keel.
Sorry.
Go ahead.
Yeah, thanks. Sorry. My concern is with the childcare that we are providing, PCA programs, DHS, and all the funding that we are doing, I continually hear about the waivers are there, the money is there, there's this, there's that. They're not happening. We're waiting 6 months for childcare to get started, and they made them redo all the information that made no sense to me at all. I couldn't understand that. So how is this going to move these things along? We're just holding it, making it unbearable. And I have a real, I don't think I'm going to support this. We have to know what these kids are doing. I'm hearing some scary things out there because family are refusing. And so we need to really think about what we're doing here. And I get that we're passing it along. However, I had some other questions, but I can tell we're going to run out of time and there are other people.
Thank you for that comment, Representative Keel. Representative Novotny.
Thank you, Chair Schultz. Very strongly an emotional case, and it's not an exact situation, but we had a death in Elk River where an eight-year-old was supposed to be getting visits from social workers, and because of the COVID restrictions, wasn't getting face-to-face visits, and she ended up starving to death and dying in her closet from malnutrition. So I think I understand the thought behind the bill, but I think face-to-face visits are very important, and for that reason, I'll have to vote no on this. And also with the daycare questions and continuing to pay daycare when they're closed, especially with the feed the children issues that just came up this week, I think it's another reason just to vote no on this.
Representative Pinto will be covering those child care provisions in his committee, so we're not going to discuss that, but it is the counties will do face-to-face visits. That is a priority. It is only when there's possible COVID or other emergencies in place. Let's see, Representative Rasmussen.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And I know that Section 3 is going to be covered in Chair Pinto's committee, but just wanted to say that I appreciate it being included in the proposal today. It's similar to a bill that Senator Eakin and I have. And just wanted to quickly ask if DHS is willing to consider or supportive of making some of those waiver changes permanent or extending beyond just this year, because I don't think the workforce crisis and childcare is going to be going away anytime soon, unfortunately. So I just think we should be looking to extend those waivers, make them permanent, or at least have a longer timeline on that. So I don't know if, Madam Chair, if anyone from DHS would be willing to speak to that.
Maybe we could speak on that offline, Representative Rasmussen, and maybe work on it the next stop.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
Okay, Representative Albright.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I'm a bit disappointed from a standpoint of the time management of this first committee of the biennium for this session. While it's important that we hear from the Commissioner of DHS, the urgency with which this bill presents itself certainly begs for a greater degree of scrutiny and attention than the 20 minutes that it has been afforded during this committee hearing. We are rushing through this, and while you might try to pacify the members of this committee with it's not the only stop that it will present itself in front of the committee, for some of us, Madam Chair, this is the only spot in which we can ask questions before it hits the floor. And so I hope this isn't a precedent-setting way that this committee will be managed in the future. And for the reasons that numerous members of my caucus have raised, particularly the fact that this has not been vetted correctly, and for the provisions in it that still have raised questions and without answers, I would strongly urge a no vote on this proposal at this time.
Thank you, Representative Albright, for that comment. This is an urgency. The governor no longer has his emergency powers because the Republicans did not want him to have the emergency powers. So we have to act quickly to respond to this urgency, which you've heard in all of the testifiers. So this will go, I'm gonna renew my motion to re-refer House File 2914 as amended to the Health, Finance, and Policy Committee as recommended. All those in favor, I think we have to do go to Ms. Hansen, thank you, to do a roll call.
Perfect, thank you. Chair Schultz?
Yes.
Vice Chair Bonner?
Yes.
Bonner, yes. Lead Albright?
No.
Albright, no. Rep Bolden?
Bolden, aye.
Bolden, aye. Rep Burkle?
Burkle, no.
Burkle, no. Rep Fisher?
Fisher, aye.
Fisher, aye. Rep Frederick?
Frederick, aye.
Frederick, aye. Rep Hansen?
Hansen, aye.
Hansen, aye. Rep Keel?
Rep Keel, no.
Keel, no. Rep Liebling?
Aye.
Liebling, aye. Rep Moeller?
Aye.
Moeller, aye. Rep Moore?
No, aye.
Moore, aye. Rep Novotny?
Novotny, no.
Novotny, no. Rep Pearson?
Pearson, no.
Pearson, no. Rep Pinto?
Aye.
Pinto, aye. Rep Rasmussen?
Rasmussen, aye.
Rasmussen, aye. Representative Robbins?
No.
Robbins, no. Representative Sandell?
Aye.
Representative Sandell, aye. Representative Schumacher, excused. 1 second. Six or 12 ayes, 6 nays, 1 excused. Chair Schultz.
Thank you, Ms. Hansen. The motion is passed. Thank you, members. Next committee hearing will be Tuesday, and we will hear about deep poverty from DHS and a presentation from our state demographer. Thanks, everyone, and we are adjourned.